Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode. Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Ask Lifehacker podcast. It is March 6th, and this week we're talking about Steam's new family sharing feature, the best TV streaming services, communication mistakes every couple makes, and poop. We're also answering your questions about Android battery life, how real cameras stack up to smartphones, and finding out how much data you use at home. And as always, we'll be going through our favorite tips and downloads of the week, so let's get started.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the show. I am Whitson Gordon.
I'm Adam Dachis.
And this week, Eric Ravenscraft is joining us via Google Hangouts. What is up, Eric?
Hello, folks.
How's it going?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for asking, Whitson. Most people don't. Because I work from home.
All right, we got some good stuff to go through today, but first, an announcement. Those of you who have been listening to the show or following the site have probably noticed that a few little sub-blogs have been popping up around Lifehacker. We talk about them at the end of every show. They include Hackerspace, our reader-run blog, and Lifehacker After Hours, our not-safe-for-work tips blog. And this week, we launched another one. It is called 2 Cents, and it is a Lifehacker blog all about personal finance. We talk about a lot of kind of finance tips and tricks on the regular Lifehacker site. But the point of the sublog is to kind of go a little bit deeper into that subject, kind of beyond the basics. For those people who are just really interested in personal finance beyond the regular stuff that we post on the site, like the other blogs, it is a separate site. If you want to follow it, you will have to follow its RSS feed or Twitter separately. You can find it on Twitter at 2CentsLH. And we will periodically share some of the bigger stories over to Lifehacker, but if you want to follow them, you will have to follow them separately to try and keep all the categories separate for people who are interested in different things as, we continue expanding. So I highly recommend checking that out. We just launched it a few days ago and they've already got some good posts up. So cool. Sweet. Oh, and it's headed up by, a new contributor to Lifehacker, Kristen Wong, who was a writer or is a writer over at Get Rich Slowly and some other finance blogs. So
a great
if you're
blog.
A fan of them, it's basically like them and Lifehacker had a baby is how one reader described it. And I'm like, that sounds accurate. All right, cool. Let's go into the news. Eric, why don't you kick us off with the first kind of bigger story of the week?
Steam's family sharing feature is now available to everyone.
What is family sharing?
Basically, you can... I think you have to be on a network with someone when you start it off, but I can allow another Steam account to access my entire library of games. They can download them, they can play all of them as much as they want, as long as I am not currently playing one of my games.
And so this is the feature that's kind of controversial about it, because it's stupid and sucks.
Oh, I disagree with you, sir.
Yeah, Eric and I had a big argument about this week. Essentially, the idea is that if I'm playing any game, the person I'm sharing with can't play any game.
Yeah.
In my opinion, it should be if we just can't play the same game at the same time.
I agree.
See, I understand why you would want that. On the other hand, not only is that a huge amount of access, because, I mean, you would basically... There would never be any restriction, really. But also, I don't really... Like, no one can use my library now anyway. It's a free thing, and you have hundreds of hours in the week to play my entire library. I don't care.
But unless I'm sharing with someone in, like, India, which is a good use of this...
Okay,
I am going to be playing games, you know, after 5 p.m. during the day at the same time that the person I'm sharing with probably
wants to play
games.
You play games way more often than I do.
I mean, so you and I couldn't share a library because you can
share my library. I play like 1 or 2 days a week.
But what if I want to play one of those days? It's just such a hassle.
Well, then it's mine.
Even
give it
more
back.
Of a hassle than World of Warcraft's Patch Tuesday was, you know,
does
when
someone
you
wanna
realize
share
like,
with
oh,
me?
Crap, I can't play.
I never play my library.
That's true. I can
just
share with
Dotches.
Dotches has like one game in his library.
I don't.
The problem here I understand what you're saying, in that it would, in theory, it would just give everyone free access to everything in Steam. But you could say the same thing about the Kindle Lending Library or about literally any industry before everything became digital. You know,
I actually just started looking into the Kindle Lending Library, so maybe I would say that. I don't know. But that sounds awesome.
It is. I can lend you a book and then you can read it and then it comes back to me when you're done. And yeah. It was like that way for a long time before everything became digital. You know, if you wanted to borrow a CD from me or a game that was on disc or a movie that was on DVD, I would lend it to you. You could watch it and I could not watch it, but I could still watch the rest of the DVDs that I had bought and were sitting in my cabinet, you know?
You could actually make the argument that that was not the case for gaming, because if I, like, the entire family, this is supposed to be like a family in one house. That's why you have to be in the same network to set it up anyway, which is the bigger restriction actually. But if we had a PlayStation, the whole family could share all of those games, but not if I'm on it. And I think that's what they're trying to emulate there.
But what if you just bought a second PS3 or whatever? Then in that case, I mean, if the family has multiple consoles and someone else has, you know, wants to borrow the game.
Steam didn't
like
think this
if
out.
A family has multiple computers, which is what this is for.
Yeah.
Again, there are slight differences there. And I see both sides to it. It's just annoying to me. And I guess that's why it's called family sharing and not friend sharing. I think what this is more useful for is sharing just across your own multiple PCs. Like, I have a PC in my living room and a PC in here, and I'd like to be able to use my Steam account on both. But if I log in on one, I have to, like, log out in the other, and it's this kind of weird hassle. I can see that being useful and just making things a little bit easier. But anyway, we'll see how it goes. I haven't used it myself, so I don't want to crap on it too much. But
it's definitely better than nothing. I mean, because I could see circumstances where I would use this.
Yeah. I didn't realize you'd be on the same Wi-Fi network.
Believe so. That's not when you, not all the time, but when you first set it up, because when you, like, I tried to set up it with another account and it says, well, where is it? Authorized account, no other local accounts found, because no other accounts are logged in on my network.
I see.
But once you leave the network, you can still share the library, I believe.
Okay.
I think that's fine, but at the same time, I just hate all the effort that gets put into these restrictive copy protection mechanisms that basically say, we know you're going to cheat and we're going to screw you over in advance. Because I don't know if that's necessarily what I would do. I'm not saying I wouldn't cheat, but I just wish there was a little bit more trust, and I don't like that they're spending money on it. You know, they're spending money and time developing ways to lock it down more. I prefer I like DRM like on a lot of the app stores where it's tied to your email address and that's that. And you can't really share those apps, so I guess that sucks, but, you know.
I hate DRM too, but Steam is fairly open as far as DRM is concerned. You know, the Mac App Store has nothing like this. Steam's DRM has always not, you know, it's not Origin or anything like that. You know, at least I can play if I'm offline.
And I will say, at the very least, there is still the classic workaround if you don't like this, that some commenters pointed out. Like, if I were to, like, give you the password to my account, which I don't want to do, but if I trust you, I can do that. You switch to offline mode, you have my whole library all the time. So
that's true.
There's still... It's not like this is the only way either, so...
That's a good point. And, you know, there's always just Steam sales, too.
Yeah, exactly.
The money really shouldn't be a factor at this point, because you can get games so insanely cheaply that it's not even worth, like, trying to steal the games.
I have 98 games in my library, and I'm bored with the ones I do play, and then I don't play the others.
Oh, yeah. So, I think I have a bunch more games because I bought a bundle once.
Yeah.
So maybe I do have more than 4 games.
It's possible. All right. Next item of news. This one's just really quick, but I thought it was cool. Google added a new feature to its kind of, I don't think this is technically a knowledge graph, but just when you search for something and it comes up with a box that's kind of smart and knows what you're asking for, it added restaurant menus. So now if you search for a menu for a restaurant, if you search like, what's a restaurant? Umami Burger menu. It'll like show you the menu right at the top of your search results, which is really cool because finding menus online is sometimes such a hassle.
Yeah, I think this is
I'm
wonderful.
So happy about this.
It's a really nice little feature, and it works with voice control too, so you can say, what is the menu for this restaurant, and it'll show you. So nice little addition. All right, moving on to top stories. Eric, you did something awesome this week. Let's talk about it
now. I did a bunch of searching, which, by the way, I just want to point out, iTunes is the worst thing to search on. I friggin' hate that. But
you could have ended that sentence with iTunes is the worst thing.
That's true. So I compared the libraries of Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and Google Play and iTunes just for fun. And to find out who has the best, widest streaming library. And
of TV shows.
Of TV shows, yes. And unsurprisingly, it's Netflix. by a pretty huge majority. Netflix had around just about half of the TV shows that I surveyed from IMDb's top 250 or whatever. And Amazon had like half of that. And Hulu had 92 out of 250, but they, like, most of those were recent episodes. So Netflix is the best for having a huge library of shows. Amazon kind of fills in the gaps a little bit, and Hulu is the one you go to for recent episodes of shows.
And Amazon's probably not worth paying for unless you already have Amazon Prime.
Yeah, that's kind of, if you want it just for the video library, it's really not, well, for TV shows. For TV shows, right. I should say, it's not probably movies. Not worth it just for that. Movies, I guess we'll do later. But
this is really interesting, because I feel like at one point in time, Hulu was better. Or they had a better library of shows or something.
Yeah.
I think it's been a little crippled by the networks.
Absolutely. Yeah. The fact that you have to wait, you know, whatever it is, a week for an episode to come out. And some shows you can only watch with a cable subscription. And some of the shows are web only instead of being able to play them on your PlayStation. It's just ridiculous. And it has complete... And the sheer amount of commercials make it just not even close to worth it for me anymore.
Yeah, this is the problem with a lot of the... with a lot of the ways the contracts work, and I hate to say this, but I think a cable company is really where this needs to come from, or someone that acts like a cable subscriber, but for the internet. If there's a new business model there, then you know.
Well, doesn't Comcast sort of have a foot in Hulu now because they're owned by NBC, who's a partner in Hulu?
Yeah, but
I don't really know how that works. But
yeah,
this whole thing is incestuous.
Yeah, but the Comcast has their own thing where you can watch online too with Xfinity.
Wait, what is that called?
Oh, Xfinity.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. If you're a Comcast subscriber,
exactly. So there's just all this stuff. But I mean, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a however much a month streaming option where you can get TV channels. Like I don't understand why. No one's pushing for that yet. Get an on-demand library for a lot of money a month, probably, but nonetheless.
I feel like I've seen companies talk about hinting at doing that, but then they never do, or they're trying to figure out the math or something. I don't know. Like, I would go for that, though. If you said, this is like Hulu, or what Hulu wanted to do, only it doesn't suck. Even if it didn't suck on the level of, like, Netflix. Netflix has, like, it's a 50-50 shot to find a show there. But I would take that over... Hulu with maybe a third of the shows, and most of them are... I just want to point out, I didn't go into detail on this, but the recent episodes thing I have on that graphic, that is a wide category. There are the last 5 episodes, the last 8 episodes, the last month of episodes, like 5 different types of categories of a rotating set of shows. Or episodes.
I think the important point here is that Netflix will give you a larger... portion of a show's library, but only up until the point where the show's been out on DVD, basically, which is
pretty much
how Netflix works. It doesn't give you the current season, which for some people is fine, but
yeah.
Anyway, you put together a really great graphic with some of the most popular shows and what services they're available on. It's really, really cool. I highly recommend checking it out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Cool.
Dodges, you talked about poop.
Yeah, I knew I knew this was coming.
Could you feel it?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, just
you knew it was
out.
Coming because it's in the rundown of the show that we're all looking at right now.
Please stop saying rundown while we're talking about this.
Yeah. Well, so we did a post called "What's the color of my pee mean?" a while ago, and we just thought, why not poop? And the reason why not poop is because then you have to have pictures of poop. But Whitson, you actually solved this problem. You're like, why not have cartoon poop? So. I took a look into, what the shape and color of poop can mean. Learned a few things I didn't know before. And there's something called the Bristol stool chart, which allows you to diagnose your poop shape and type, and you know, type one and two means you're constipated, three and four means you have great poop, it looks like a sausage or a snake, you're good to go. And then five through seven,
I'm really glad
is on the
you
way
cut
to
out
diarrhea.
Right after you said sausage, it was hilarious.
The five to seven is on the way to diarrhea, seven is actually diarrhea. But you can look, we posted the chart if you know haven't eaten yet. You might want to go check out the article to look that up. But we also talk about color, and color can be indicative of a bunch of problems. It can also mean you ate a beet or a lot of spinach last night, and that can that can cause color. So there's a lot of, like, it's kind of like reading your future. You're not, there's a lot of interpretation that's involved when it comes to interpreting your poop. So, you know, it's good to know a few things, but it's also good to consult your doctor if you actually have a concern. And that's
cool.
It. That's I'm done with poop for this segment of the show.
All right. I just wanted to call attention. I didn't write that much this week, but Milani did a post that I really liked called Five Communication Mistakes Almost Every Couple Makes. And it was actually really well put together. And it was slightly different than some of the other kind of relationship-y posts that we've done. And it's funny that everyone who reads this kind of, A, recognizes almost all of them immediately. Like, oh yeah, I've definitely experienced that before, because it's just something that is so common. And almost everyone could pick out one on their list that was like their pet problem or like their partner's problem.
I haven't seen this. What were some of the
mistakes? Ironically was one of the problems.
Oh, it's great. So it's things like assuming that more communication is the solution, or the opposite, expecting your partner to read your mind and know what you want at all times, and then getting mad when they don't, you know, follow through on something that you want but didn't say.
I actually don't do that, but everyone I've been with does that. I am the anti-mind reader. I like try to tell people that ahead of time. You need to tell me what's going on, because I'm not going to assume.
Yeah,
I'm the opposite of that. Like, I always try to figure out what people are thinking.
Oh, I do.
And
I'm
that
wrong.
Gets really annoying. Oh, see, I don't want to say I'm right more often than not, but
you
I am
right
more often than
right
not.
More often than not. Let's be real.
No, it's fine. I'm true. Stupid, so it's.
But no, I'm the one who are like I know something's wrong. We need to talk about it. Like, let's talk about this thing, and then that ends up making people more pissed off than they should be. And my girlfriend actually just got on to me about that this week. But but I like that first one mostly because. Like she talks about like doing other things besides talking about it. And that was the hardest. Now, if I feel like there's a problem, the first thing I do, this is going to sound cheesy as hell, but first thing I do is smile and find something to justify it.
Justify the smile?
Yes. To justify the smile. Like, I'm pissed off about something, or I know you're pissed off about something. So I smile and then let's go do something fun, or let's
interesting
or say something sweet or something. To get the topic off of there's a problem.
Right. One of the most awesome and weirdest tips I ever heard was when you're fighting with your significant other, like actually kind of like having a fight, stop and get naked. Because it's really hard to be super angry when people are naked. And the whole thing just goes much smoother. Anyway, I highly recommend reading Milani's post. It isn't about being naked. But it's got some good tips in there, and it's honestly, you read it, you'll know exactly what they're talking about just by reading each subhead, because it's something that we've kind of all been through a lot and probably go through on a regular basis with our significant others. So it's good stuff. Cool. All right, let's move on to the fun stuff. Questions. Anthony is going to start us off, and he asks, I love my Android phone, but I've noticed that if I go somewhere that doesn't have a data or phone signal, my phone battery will drain really quickly. I know that I can toggle my data off with airplane mode manually, but is there an app or another method that can do this automatically for me? Eric, I want to point this to you because you're the Android expert. I thought of Juice Defender.
That is a good option, particularly if you're like, say you're on T-Mobile in Arkansas or some place that doesn't have people in it.
Every Arkansas listener just started hating you.
It's okay. I actually already have plenty of people in Arkansas who hate me, as is. So,
so you're saying there are plenty of people in Arkansas.
Like, in one little section. So, camera just went blurry and I don't know how to, okay, there we go. Anyway, Juice Defender is good because that will, like, it'll cut off whatever communication you want. Like, it'll turn off your wireless data and only turn it back on every few minutes to check in and make sure you got a message. So if you're consistently having problems just everywhere, that's a good option. Another option you can use is Tasker, and specifically a plugin called Auto Location, which enables you to use what are called geofences in Tasker. Basically, if there's a problem area that you know of, like every time I go to this one place
or something.
What was that?
Like your office or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If you go to your office and you know you get bad signal at your office, you can use this plugin and Tasker to say, every time I'm here, turn off data. Or turn it off for a period of time and come back on only here. Juice Defender might be able to filter by location, I forget, but if not, this works for specific areas. So it kind of depends on what type of, like, what your specific problem is, but
yeah. And if you have Wi-Fi at that specific area,
exactly,
Wi-Fi,
that too.
Get the best of both worlds. The other, yeah, it's hard if it doesn't. I can't tell from his question whether he's having this problem regularly at a specific location or if he's just, you know, in a yeah. rural area and doesn't get very good service many of the places that he goes. And that's probably a little bit tougher. I don't know of an app that will just turn off your data when you don't have data, you know?
Yeah.
But hopefully the auto location, that's probably the best option, I think. You're
yeah.
right.
And if it is just... you just need it to turn off data when you don't have data. Juice Defender, like, you can do Juice Defender every 2 minutes and you'll never notice.
Yeah.
I mean,
the other thing is that if you, you know, Android has the quick settings pull down and
right.
stuff like that. And if you use something like CyanogenMod, it'll make it even easier to access, or something like Exposed Framework will make it easier to access, which means you can turn airplane mode on and off really, really easily with like two taps. So
yeah, exactly.
In it, when in doubt, or if nothing else works, you can try and make airplane mode more accessible, or maybe put a widget on your home screen or lock screen or something like that.
Right.
The power.
Also,
control
I'm not sure, you didn't
Android.
Say what phone he has, but if you're using anything remotely close to stock Android, like CyanogenMod, two swipes down from your status bar to pull down the settings.
Oh, that's right. I knew that. And I totally forgot. It used to be if you pulled down from the right edge, which is what yeah. I have it set to with Exposed. But you're
oh,
right.
Okay.
In newer versions of Android, it's if you pull down with two fingers, you get the... Okay, awesome.
Yep.
Thank you for that extra tip. I forgot.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
All right, Dotches, this question is probably for you.
Uh-oh.
Gavin asks, with a new baby on the way very shortly, I want to make sure to preserve the memories with some nice photos. I currently have a point-and-shoot and an iPhone 4S, but I'm wondering if it's worth upgrading to a DSLR or mirrorless camera. I'm leaning toward the Sony NEX 3N. There are some good deals on right now, and I don't mind spending the money if it means significantly better photos, but not if it's only marginally better.
Okay, so there are a couple of things to talk about here. I would definitely recommend going with Sony in this case, as much as I'm a big Canon fan, and I like what they do, and I think they make great cameras, and I think Nikon makes great cameras too, and they're all, you know, I guess I could just probably
you just, so
list
you like
all
everybody.
I like everybody for something. Can't, you know, it's not worth getting into, but I think Sony offers the most options since you are obviously comfortable with a phone, you like using the phone, you want to put the photos on your phone, but you want better quality. Sony has a nice link up with the cameras they make now, because they all have Wi-Fi, and you can, and they all have a send a smartphone feature where you can get a Play Memories app on Android or iPhone and just send the photos over the Wi-Fi like that. Like your phone connects via Wi-Fi, and in some cases they have NFC in them, so this is not going to help you because you have an iPhone, but Android phones can just tap onto it and then it will connect to the Wi-Fi network automatically, so it's a lot faster. But if you're out and about or something and you just launch the Wi-Fi network on your Sony camera, then the iPhone will find it pretty quickly and you don't have to do it manually. So that is a huge advantage if you are talking about getting higher quality, but you want to also use your smartphone for dealing with those photos afterwards. I think you don't necessarily need to go to a DSLR level. Sony's DSLRs are nice. Their mirrorless cameras, I think, are really the sweet spot in terms of quality and size. I like the... And price, yes, thank you. I use an NEX6, and I think that's really great. I think if you're not looking for something really, you know, you don't need a ton of manual features, the 3 or the 5 are also phenomenal. And I mean, they, whatever the latest variant of that is, because there's like the 5N and the 3N and so on. And then you can get a couple of lenses that suit you. One other thing to consider, however, is the Sony RX100, or the preferably, I guess, the Sony RX100 Mark II. And that is actually a point-and-shoot camera, but the quality is phenomenal. It is very close to what you'll achieve with one of the mirrorless cameras. You don't get to swap out your lenses or anything else like that, but it's a point-and-shoot. It's small. It's much easier to take with you. It's what I generally use as my camera when I'm going out, and I don't, you know, I'm not satisfied with the phone. So
what's the price differential between something like that and something like a Sony mirrorless?
You'll get a much better deal on a Sony NEX3N or whatever the case may be these days, whatever the latest one is. You can probably pick up one of those for about $400 and then put some money into an extra lens, because you're going to want that. The lenses it comes with aren't great. I'd recommend getting the 35, but that you're looking at like $400 there. Although for the most part, you're looking at $400 for a lens for that camera. So if you start getting lenses, you're looking at somewhere around $700-$800 for an NEX camera, which is, I think, why they're so cheap to buy into, because you're buying into a system. Whereas with the RX100, you can pick that up for about $550, and the RX100 Mark II, I think, is at $750 right now, but you won't be buying peripherals for that. So you
gotta... Is it better than the NEX with the default lens?
I can't say that technically speaking, but I'm more pleased with the pictures it produces than the default lens that the NEX cameras come with. However, if you do want to know what the NEX cameras look like, what the lens looks like, just watch this podcast, because I'm using the default zoom lens right now, and I'm on an NEX VG30, so it's not like the quality's bad. It's nice looking. So,
and I think the other thing here that I think you touched on, but part of his question is it worth the money to upgrade to one of these cameras versus an iPhone? And I think the answer is absolutely yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, the iPhone likes to think that its camera is great, and it is really great for a smartphone.
It doesn't suck like horribly. It's probably the best camera you'll find on a phone, save for maybe the Nokia Lumia line. But it's still, I mean, the difference between that and a DSLR or a mirrorless is night and day.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, what we're talking about is on a cell phone, and especially on the iPhone, when lighting conditions are great, you're going to get great pictures, and that's why you see all these amazing photos taken with an iPhone, because people know how to light properly, or they happen to be in good lighting conditions. However, when you don't, you know, when you don't, you're not carrying around a lighting kit with you, which probably not with a baby because it's dangerous, you're gonna have a much better time with a camera that's meant to handle low light situations. DSLRs are obviously better equipped for that, because you can get faster lenses with meaning wider apertures are possible. So you can get much higher quality photos that way. So that's the bonus. But also with the camera like the RX100 or RX100 Mark II, that camera is specifically designed to handle low light well. And it does a great job, and it has, for its entire lifespan, has been the point and shoot to buy for basically people who want great photos, want DSLR quality, but don't want this something that big or even something as big as a mirrorless camera.
Yeah. Cool. And I found a link. F-Stoppers has a pretty good comparison between the iPhone camera and a DSLR. That'll kind of show you what the difference is. It's just the DSLRs are much more consistent, especially, like you said, across low light. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
It really helps to see it.
It's absolutely crazy.
You see it and you'll be convinced.
Yeah. All right, Kendra writes, like most people, I pay a flat fee for internet access. I'm on the web all day, but I don't download any movies, so I wonder if my bandwidth usage is lower than my neighbors. More importantly, I'm thinking about moving to a pay-as-you-go internet provider. Something like Freedom Pop and others let you pay by the gigabyte. I don't know if this will be cheaper than my current flat rate because I don't know how much bandwidth I use. Is there any way to determine my current monthly bandwidth usage? There are a few sides to this. One thing that you're going to have to kind of worry about with something like Freedom Pop is how good of service you get inside your home. It's not going to be as reliable as something like cable internet.
Mine was actually really good, but really? There are a lot of places where it's completely non-existent too.
Yeah, so it really depends on where you are.
You have to see.
And you know, how fast it is too, because the speed can kind of, I think, fluctuate a little bit more than...
I got about 6 to 7 megabits per second. You just check the Sprint service area.
Okay. So anyway, to get to your main question, which is how do you find out how much bandwidth you're currently using, the best way is to go to your ISP's website, log into your account, and they'll usually have an area where you can see how much bandwidth you use every month. There are other ways to do it. You can install a program on your computer or monitor it from your router, but going to your ISP's website is definitely the best way, and we have a post with more information on that for a bunch of different providers, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But it should be really easy to find if you just go to your, you know, Comcast or Charter or whoever is your provider, go to their website, log into your account, you'll find it. Okay, let's move on to a few live questions. Related to what we were just talking about, Liam has a question about cameras. So Natchez, I'll shoot this over to you first. I have a mirrorless camera, but I want to use high-range telephoto lenses. Am I better off going with a lens adapter like the Nikon F mount or a full DSLR?
Okay, I'm not sure I totally understand what he's asking. He has a mirrorless camera. He wants to use high-range telephoto lenses.
So should he use a lens adapter mirrorless camera or get a DSLR?
Okay, I wish I knew what the camera was. because it depends. Like Sony, for example, it sounds like it might be a Nikon one. If he's talking about although a lot of people just Nikons are, you know, old Nikon lenses, and they're very easy to, they're cheap to get, and people mount them on all sorts of things. So who knows? But one of the advantages of the Sony cameras is Sony has an adapter for Sony DSLR lenses, and it has proper autofocus and everything. So if you have one of the Sony mirrorless cameras, I feel like I'm an ad for Sony today. But if you have one of the Sony mirrorless cameras, getting an adapter is actually really good, and it's worth sticking with it. I'm also, you know, not convinced there isn't a good good enough telephoto lens for a mirrorless camera. Let's just presume for the case, since he seems to believe that there isn't. For the camera he's using. Getting a DSLR is, like, if you want super long range, like I want to take pictures of the moon and the stars long range, DSLRs are just going to be better. But you're talking about investing a lot of money. The longer that zoom range gets, I mean, once you get past 300 millimeters, basically, it is expensive. It's really, really expensive, especially if you get a decent one. Because you can, the problem is you can get cheap telephotos, but they're really shaky, and it actually does, stabilization really matters, aperture really matters. You don't want to get a cheap telephoto. That's a really tough question to answer. I would say get an adapter if autofocus matters to you, and the adapter can handle autofocus well. Otherwise, you need to look at a DSLR because you're not going to get what you want.
Cool. Apparently it's camera day at the Lifehacker Show because Evan has a question about cameras, sort of. He says, I received an iPad mini for Christmas and I'm having a hard time figuring out what role it should play. One thing I would like to try is using it as a way to view photos from my DSLR. Do you have any suggestions on how to do so?
Get a camera kit. Because they have that iPad camera kit. Hopefully your DSLR uses uses SD and not compact flash, in which case you're kind of screwed there. But if you have a Sony camera,
you can
just transfer them over Wi-Fi. Other cameras do that. So it's not just Sony.
Didn't we do a post on this?
Oh yeah, I did a post on this.
I was gonna say, I'll put it in the show notes for you, Evan.
There are ways to remotely transfer your photos, but the best thing you can probably do in terms of an iPad and a standard DSLR, if you're using SD, SDHC, SDXC, whatever, SD cards of some kind, is to just get the camera kit, because it's like $30. You plug it into the bottom, and then you can just import the photos.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. All right, we have two questions about processors.
Oh, good. Is one of them Casper's?
Yes.
No, it's Sony.
Both of these are really, really broad questions and require not only more information, but probably require that the askers do more research on what they're looking for. Casper says, what is the best not overclocked processor that you can buy? Which is an impossible question to answer because, there are really powerful ones you could buy for thousands and thousands of dollars. and Daniel asks, Intel Core i7 or Xeon? So, okay, both of you need to back up for a second and think about what you're doing and how much you want to spend, because there are way more processors out there than you think, it sounds like. And you need to think about what you're using these for. If you're building a gaming computer, get an i5 and call it a day. That's all you need. Like, i7 is completely unnecessary. Anything above that is completely unnecessary. If you're doing things like video editing, something like an i7 or one of the 6-core i7s, like the Ivy Bridge E processors or Xeon, are really great. But the higher you go, the more you're paying for something that you may or may not notice depending on what you're doing. It depends on how CPU heavy your tasks are, et cetera, et cetera. Xeons are much more expensive, but you're going to get like an 8-core processor. It's probably overkill for a lot of people. But if you're doing a lot of really heavy video editing, could be worth it.
Can I make I'm going to be arrogant and assume I know what they're asking.
Okay, go for it.
When we're talking about i7 or Xeon i7, you're going to spend too much money on a Xeon. Intel's overpriced them. I was talking to Tony Mack, the Hackintosh guy, about this, and it's just not affordable for someone to buy and build a Xeon system for the most part. It's cheaper to buy one that's made for you. So it's really, there's really like no
I know that's
benefit.
True with Macs. Is that true with PCs, though?
It should be. Mac Pro is very expensive.
Well, I guess PCs always cheaper to buy than build, technically. But that's true. I'm using an Ivy Bridge E processor. It's got 6 cores. It's kind of a good, in my opinion, it's a good in-between if you actually are doing a lot of CPU-heavy tasks like video editing, but you don't want to spend a crap ton of money, but you want something more than just what a regular consumer-grade i7 will do. Ivy Bridge E isn't bad. But again, you got to think about what you're doing. And, if you don't need an insane amount of CPU power, a regular i5 or i7 is totally fine and is overkill for the majority of people.
Yeah.
And when your questions are that broad, it leads me to believe that you haven't done a lot of research and maybe don't really know what you're using this processor for yet. And I don't mean to assume things about these question askers, but it sounds like you need to do a little more research.
Well, I want to just add one thing here with in terms of the best processor that's not overclocked. I don't know anything about AMD processors, so I can't speak to the broad range of what's available. But in terms of Intel, I was actually looking at this specifically because I'm updating our Hackintosh guide today, and seeing what is the most affordable but powerful build. And after going through all the different Intel processors that will work with Hackintoshes, I was looking at overclocking on a Hackintosh is really not very valuable, but I was looking at the processors, and the non-overclocked Core i5 hits a very good price point, sweet spot to power ratio. It's basically not that much slower than the most powerful Core i7. It loses a couple of features that most people probably won't care about, but it comes in at $209 instead of like $360. So you save a ton of money on it, and the speed difference is minimal, and it's actually faster on the single core side. So
yep.
Let me just look at this because I brought it up. It's the i5-4670. It's 3.4 gigahertz, and it's $209, at least on Amazon. I'm assuming it's the same everywhere. But if we're talking about like what's the best non-overclock processor and we have nothing else to go on that, that would be my answer.
Yeah, there's a difference between number of cores and how fast the processor is on a single core. You know, for things like gaming, you're better off with fewer cores and a faster processor.
Yeah,
at least at the moment, that's changing soon. But, you know, most games don't use more than one or two cores.
Yeah, and so this is going to be probably better for most things in terms of speed. And it's not that much slower on the multi-core.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be sacrificing anything noticeable.
Yeah. So if you're building a computer, I highly recommend going and checking out our guide to building a computer and thinking about what you're using this processor for and looking at the prices of the processors, because just throwing money at processors isn't necessarily the best option. In fact, it rarely is. All right. Let's do one last question, because this is a good one. Do you guys know what hardware acceleration is on browsers, and why does it affect gaming on my browser? So this is a pretty easy question. Hardware acceleration is, in any program, not just browsers, but hardware acceleration is basically your computer handing off CPU-intensive tasks to your graphics card. So if you have a decent graphics card in your computer, it can kind of take some of the load off your CPU. And since graphics cards are pretty powerful, can help make that gaming smoother or better. Regular video games use your graphics card for a lot, but in your browser, they don't necessarily, unless you turn on hardware acceleration. A lot of that is usually offloaded to put on the CPU instead. So if you're gaming in a browser, hardware acceleration is a useful feature to have, provided you have, you know, a decent graphics card. I don't know how well it would work with something like integrated graphics. It's been a long time since I've used them for anything that mattered. But yeah, hardware acceleration is pretty cool. I have seen it cause problems sometimes, but usually you don't have to worry about that unless you have graphical issues. Turn hardware acceleration off and see if it fixes them. But that's a really, really basic kind of introduction to hardware acceleration. All right, let's move on to tips and downloads of the week. Eric, why don't you start us
yes.
off?
Yes. I don't know. No.
I didn't get that for a second.
No, Thor did a post saying, why saying I don't know adds credibility? And basically the idea is that, I mean, we make up stuff for answers all the time, which is why I'm not actually talking about the processors thing. I should know about processors, but I don't. So I'm keeping out of that topic. But when you have someone who admits that they don't necessarily know a topic, that makes them seem more like that they will be honest about the information that they don't have. As opposed to someone who kind of makes up an answer as they're going, and you can tell that they don't know what they're talking about. And then not only are they not knowledgeable now, but they're a liar too.
Cool. I like it. Yeah.
I like it too because it says we're all idiots.
It's true.
Yeah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, my tip is about how to view and erase your Facebook search history. A lot of people don't know this, but Facebook logs everything you search for.
That doesn't surprise me. I didn't.
It
know
doesn't
that.
Actually surprise me at all. I just didn't realize. You know, it's one of those things that you don't know it's there until you find it, mm-hmm. and it's buried under a number of menus. But if you go to your activity log, which you can get from the gear icon in Facebook, and then click the More button on the left sidebar, you will see a search section of your activity log, and that is where Facebook logs everything you have ever searched for. This isn't really a huge problem unless you have people that are actively looking for this and there's something in there you don't want people to see. But it can be nice to, it also can be nice to see it if you are like, man, I found something last week via Facebook search, but I don't remember what the name of it was. You can go back to this menu and find it in your search history. Or if you want to erase it for one reason or another, there is a clear searches button, which you can click and everything will go away, at least from, you know, your private view. I'm sure Facebook keeps those things logged for eternity on their own servers, but it won't be on your side. And it's also important to say that you're the only person that can see this. So the only reason you might need to protect this is if someone else has a password to your account and they, you know, there's something you don't want them to see or something like that.
Or they're using
your computer. Just leave your desktop logged in.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. Like and you're searching for, like, you know, porn stars or something on Facebook. Or
all okay, that's time. Just the worst
ex,
idea, though.
Ex-girlfriends or whatever it is.
I haven't done that yet, but I'm going to now.
I mean, I'm How sure they're all
the best
on
porn stars on Facebook.
For the same reason that, like, we're on Facebook, you know, self-promotion and all that. Makes
Did
sense.
You just call us porn stars, Winston?
I'm just saying.
I mean, maybe.
So that's there.
People don't know everything about us.
I'll put a link in the show notes that shows you how to find and erase your Facebook search history. Dachis, why don't you tell us about your tip?
Okay. Well, actually, this tip comes from Milani, and I just thought it was so funny that I had to choose it. It's about putting a mirror in the kitchen so you're more self-conscious about what you eat. It can help you eat more healthily. And I thought this was really interesting because if I ever if I ever look at myself before I'm about to eat and I think there's a little too much, I think I gained 5 pounds in my ear. So,
hold on, a little too much what? Do you have pounds on you?
No,
anywhere.
No, but I mean, I've weighed more than this before, so
okay.
It's so there. I mean, I've been like moderately self conscious about my, I wouldn't say weight, but you know, body, I guess, a little bit, and so if I ever have been, you know, the mirror would always encourage me to be a little bit more thoughtful about what I'm eating, and so I thought it was interesting that there's actually a study about this where if you put a mirror in the kitchen. Or in the dining room or wherever you're eating, that you'll be more thoughtful about that because you'll be looking at yourself and you'll see yourself judging you for what you're eating.
It sounds like a horrible way to live.
I love self-shaming as a tip.
Constantly seeing your looking into your own judgy eyes everywhere you go around your house.
That's how I solve nail biting, though. I mean, I recorded myself scolding myself for nail biting and then watched
I remember
the video.
That.
Do you still have this video?
Yeah, somewhere. I did not post it online, but I did write a post about it. So
I remember that. That was awesome.
It's oddly effective. So
okay, then.
I do recommend it if you really want to feel bad but actually get the job done.
Have you considered offering that service, like recording scolding videos for other people?
You know what? If someone wants to pay me to do that, I'm not opposed to it.
Put that up on Fiverr.
I might
that's
that
a Fiverr
free.
Thing.
It is. That is okay. Well, I've got somewhere to be after this podcast. Just FYI. See you guys later.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on to our downloads.
Okay,
Eric, you're first.
Okay, so I'm specifically doing this one because I have an internal controversy over it. But HitBliss. A couple commenters mentioned this on the comments of the TV streaming post. Basically, HitBliss allows you to just sit and watch a whole bunch of ads, maybe interact with some, and in doing that, you earn credits to buy or rent movies and television shows online. So, like, during that infographic, we learned that, like, 90% of all the TV shows were available to buy on Amazon, or to rent on Amazon, I think.
But not to stream.
Yeah, well, if you add them to your library, you
can
stream
for free
with
your Prime subscription.
Right, exactly. You couldn't get it with Prime, but you can pay money for it. HitBliss allows you to do that with movies, and apparently for just some customers, they're experimenting with doing that through Amazon itself. So
it's kind of like when you go to the airport and you have to watch an ad before you can access their free Wi-Fi.
Exactly.
Or like on
Although
Hulu, where you can choose to watch a 2-minute ad before your show instead of having commercials interrupt you.
Right, only way longer. Like, I did it this morning, and it was, like, 10 to 15 minutes of ads, and you have to, like, sit there, and, like, every so often they'll say, are you paying attention? Hit enter, and hit enter.
Oh,
and it's,
that's
it's
interesting that they do that now, because I go to the bathroom during those 2-minute ads.
Yeah, well, I mean, for Hulu, it wouldn't do that, but for this thing, like, you're supposed to be earning money to do that, and it's a full-screen Windows app. I think it's for Mac and Android, too, so
what
it's not
like
multiple
monitors?
I actually don't know. I should try that out. But you still have to be... Well, no, because if you change focus, then it still says, like, we're pausing the video now. So,
dang. This thing is...
It's super strict.
It's very strict.
On the
Whatever,
other hand...
I have a laptop.
Yeah. On the other hand, it took like 10 to 15 minutes to incur enough credit to where I rented like a $5 movie rental.
It's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good return on investment. So like, I kind of hate myself for doing it, mostly because I watched like this. There are like 10 ads and I watched five of them three times. But on the other hand, I get to go watch Simon Pegg be in a movie now for free. So I don't know. It depends on how much self-loathing you have. And
how much money you don't want to spend.
Exactly.
If you're like completely broke and you want to watch movies, it's not a bad way to do it.
I can see you doing this once a week for a movie night. There are other limitations too, like you can't.
Well, the nice thing is you don't have to watch them right before you watch the movie. You know, like if I'm sitting around cooking dinner or something, I can have my laptop and be like watching the commercials, like queuing up my credit for after dinner movie.
That's a very good way to do that. So, yeah.
Cool. I like it. Hit Bliss, and that is for Windows, Mac, and Android.
Yes,
it's not for iOS. That's very strange.
I think they might be working on an iOS app.
There must be the only developer ever that developed for Android before iOS.
Yeah, it says coming soon there. So.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Name is Hit Bliss. My download this week is called YouTube Resize. It does exactly what it sounds like. And it is for Chrome and Firefox. Although when I tried it on Firefox, it did not work correctly. But it works great on Chrome.
Wait, Whitson, what's Firefox?
So YouTube, first of all, here's a little YouTube tip baked into this because I always forget about this, but YouTube videos are always a little bit too small for me. I would like them to take up more of the screen without them having to be full screen. And there is that little rectangle icon in the bottom right-hand corner of the YouTube player that lets you expand it to the full width, at least, of the web page, which is nice. YouTube Resize kind of makes it a little bit more controlled and lets you go bigger. You basically click and drag the corner of the video, just like you would any window on a computer, to make it as big or as small as you want. It's really smooth, really responsive, at least on Chrome, and it is a great way to make your YouTube videos as big as you want without necessarily going full screen and sacrificing the rest of your monitor. So it's called YouTube Resize. It's for Chrome and sort of Firefox.
And even if you don't want that particular extension, you should go to Thorin's post just to see Gandalf zooming into your face.
I was wondering if you picked this download just for that.
You know, seeing Gandalf sax guy is really, it does have subconscious implications on my personal biases. You know, it's kind of like, I've realized that if we put a picture of the TARDIS from Doctor Who in the image of any post, people will automatically like the heck out of that post on Facebook. Like, it could be the worst post ever, and people will just be like, this is amazing, TARDIS!
You could try that out.
Yeah, so it's that's just like a little sneaky trick I'm using to get people to like stuff. No, it's not. But this, I'm pretty sure that's what made me like this post.
I put Gandalf the TARDIS in everything.
Doctor Who hacker.
Thorin
has a really good gif of it in action. If you just go to the post, you can kind of see what it looks like. It's pretty cool. Anyway, YouTube Resize.
I guess that leaves me.
It does.
I don't have one download, but many, as we sometimes do. I was really happy to see Thorin's post this week on the Non-Jailbreaker's Guide to iOS Emulation. And if you're familiar with iOS and emulation together, you know that Apple's not so fond of emulators in the App Store. Sometimes they leak in and you can grab them and that's great, but
then they go down like 10 minutes later.
Yeah, so if you don't get it, you don't get it. And if you want to do some emulation, you kind of have to jailbreak and download the emulators from Cydia. However, there's been a new method that kind of opened up in the last year. Apple has an enterprise developer certificate thing that they do, where if a company wants to deploy an app to anybody without going to the App Store, so they don't have to go through any process with Apple because it's just, you know, for their company's use, they can get the certificate and then create a manifest online, and people can just click a button to download it, basically, and it installs the certificate on their phone, and they can install one app from that company, or one app under that certificate. So what some tricky developers have done is get an enterprise certificate and do that for iOS apps. And so you can now download all these, you can basically sideload from the internet a bunch of emulators. That's been the primary purpose of this enterprise thing for the rest of us. So it means you can get a lot of emulators on your iPhone if you know where to go, and this post shows you how to go there and get them. So I highly recommend checking that out if you're not a jailbreaker, if you can't jailbreak for some reason, or you just don't want to. It's definitely worth it. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
There are a few other tips too. There are a few emulators like Game Boy and NES that you can actually play.
Oh, and the web browser. Yeah, I forgot.
Which is cool. And he also gives a few good sources like Touch Arcade to follow, so you can keep up with when some of these emulators leak onto the App Store and grab them as soon as they leak. Because once you grab it, you have it for life as long as you keep it back up in iTunes, even if they pull it from the App Store. So that's, you know, if you can follow that and get the emulators you want, it's
for life.
Less of a hassle. Yes, for life. All right, that is it for us today. Thanks for watching the show, guys. Please leave us a rating or a review on iTunes if you like the show. That's awesome. That helps us out a ton. If you want to keep up with any of these tips and downloads and stories as they happen throughout the week, our podcast is just a tiny weekly thing we do. We're running a big site that posts a ton of stuff every day. You can follow the site on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Facebook at Facebook.com/Lifehacker, and on Google Plus at Google.com/Lifehacker. You can also follow all of us individually on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, and you can find our individual accounts at Lifehacker.com/about. You can also follow our sublogs, which now include Hackerspace at Hackerspace.Lifehacker.com, After Hours at AfterHours.Lifehacker.com, which is our life hacking the not safe for work side of life, and 2 cents, our personal finance sublog that launched this week at 2cents.lifehacker.com. You can find the show notes for this episode in the description of this podcast. You can find the show notes for this and every other episode of the show going back to the beginning of time at lifehacker.com/the show. The show notes usually go up on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific time. The show airs live on YouTube at around 10 a.m. Pacific time, though it varies depending on how late we are being at stuff. That's it for us. Thanks for listening, guys. We will see you next week.
If you'd like to ask us a question, send an email to tips+askLHshow@lifehacker.com or give us a call at 347-687-8109. Keep your questions as short as you can so we can keep the show moving right along. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.